Similar to a well-tuned automobile, a guitar requires the same level of attention to perform at its very best. No matter how expensive your guitar may be, we will treat you and your instrument with the utmost respect. Call 920-723-1733 or visit jeffsguitar.com. Jeff's Guitar Clinic in Fort Atkinson. We love guitars.
The attorneys at Gingras, Thompson, and Wachs have had the honor of receiving numerous awards for their work both in and outside the courtroom. But just as important as receiving accolades for being skilled attorneys, it's equally important to give back to the community in which they live and work. If you want a personal attorney that can help you in so many different areas, they've got them. They're in Eau Claire, Madison, Milwaukee, and Waukesha. They're easy to reach. GTWLawyers.com. That's GTWLawyers.com.
Welcome to another podcast. Sly's Office.com, brought to you by our friends at the Operating Engineers, Local 139, Madison Firefighters, Madison Teamsters, and of course, Madison Teachers. All right, John Nichols from the Capital Times and the Nation joins us this morning. John, your friend, and I know someone who you hang on every word he says, Brett Stevens from the New York Times, said this on Meet the Press yesterday.
Same thing that we did in 09. It worked then. Here's the issue, though. In 09, it was clear the economy was still going south when they decided to essentially unanimously oppose Obama's relief bill. The economy is going to take off like a rocket ship in the next 9 months. What's this going to look like a year from now if the Democrats get to go say, hey, we passed this, they stood on the sidelines?
Yeah, that's a possibility. The other possibility is that when you're injecting close to $2 trillion into a growing economy, you're going to see the kind of inflationary pressures that we didn't have 12 years ago, precisely for the same reason, that the economy was going south. I think the Republicans are actually, from their point of view, playing this pretty smartly. The minimum wage provisions hurt small businesses. And people forget that just, 8 weeks ago, we had a $900 billion relief package pass Congress. So the Republican argument, I think, is that the United States government is like an anaconda that's eating one too many alligators here. There's only so much that we can digest and money that we can pump out in a reasonable span of time.
I don't remember him making that argument when we were flowing all that money to the banks. I don't remember that. Maybe he said something, but I don't remember that.
No, look, here's where the problem is. Some of our friends get a little bit concerned about inflation, deficits, debt. You know, you run down the list of things that bother them whenever the Democrats are in charge, right? And this is where the problem comes in. And there are things that, I will be honest with you, there are even some centrist Democrats who fall into this trap as well. And that is because it's not that they really mind spending a lot of money. It's not that they mind the government going into debt and having deficits. That doesn't bother them at all. That's obvious that it doesn't bother them at all, because they do it whenever they're in charge. Republicans do it whenever they're in charge. What they mind is the possibility of success, right? They get very, very concerned because their memories are long, and that's to their credit. They know something that I think a lot of Democrats don't know, and that is, historically, when Democrats have gone big, really big, that's when they've done the best, right? And so you think, well, what do you mean by that? We're a quote-unquote closely divided country, and you can't take too strong a stand on one side. Well, I mean, Franklin Roosevelt went big, and he won 1932, 1936, 1940, 1944, and he won all the midterm elections in there as well. In fact, the Democrats had, during Roosevelt, a period which I think it's generally agreed, he went big on economic issues, and he went big against fascism. Democrats were soaring. They had a really good ride. And you think, well, okay, that was just one guy. That just happened one time. Actually, no. Think about Lyndon Johnson. In 1964, right as he had come into the presidency, inheriting it from John Kennedy. What was Johnson doing? He was signing massive civil rights legislation. He was talking about a war on poverty and Medicare, Medicaid, all of this incredibly big activist government and all sorts of avenues, certainly the most activist since FDR. What happened? An FDR-style landslide, one of the biggest victories in history. And so I think the Republicans genuinely fear that a $2 trillion stimulus and maybe another one coming after that and an infrastructure plan after that might actually get this economy roaring, doing really well. And I regret to say there might be a little bit of inflation. But, you know, the thing is, there might be some inflation in the wages of workers. And there might be some inflation in the, you know, the spending power of people who historically have been not on the winning side of,
well,
a lot of our economic calculation.
Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen is a pretty responsible player. She is.
Yeah, I know it's not going to get too crazy out there.
She's not going to get too crazy. And if she's saying we need this, I have a fair amount of faith in her.
I have a fair amount of faith in the governor of West Virginia.
Jim Justice. Yeah.
Yeah, he's a Republican.
Who, by the way, is on a roll right now. He's doing a great job of getting his state vaccinated.
Yep.
And of course, you know, this is still the state of Robert Byrd. People in West Virginia, they don't oppose that money coming back to their state.
Well, of course they don't.
And by the way,
minimum wage increase either.
Andy Beshear is pretty popular governor in Kentucky. He's touting this. And that's one of Trump, you know, those are some of Trump's best states.
No, look, this, well, try. Let's pause for a second. Who else touted, you know, sending money out to people? Trump.
Donald Trump, yes. Yeah. Now he won't support it, but.
Well, he's a cynic and an awful person. But it's important to understand that when he was in, you know, when he was president, still trying to cling to that office, he was in the forefront talking about those $2,000 checks. And the truth is, that's the really important point, I think, for us to keep an eye on, is Republicans who are complaining about the Democrats wanting to spend a bunch of money right now, if the Democrats don't spend a bunch of money right now and Republicans nominate Donald Trump in 2024, what do you think the first thing Donald Trump's going to say is?
He's going to say the same thing Republicans said when Barack Obama was running for re-election in 2012. Slow economy, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, right.
I agree with that totally. I think that probably is first, but as a codicil to that, I think he would also say, and remember, I wanted to give you $2,000 check, and I didn't want to means test it and limit who could get it and then nickel and dime it down to 1,400 and stuff like that. I was ready to give each and every one of you that $2,000.
Well, I think they've done this responsibly. It's up to $75,000, and after that, it's gradually phased out. And then if you make over $100,000, you know, get anything. Let's talk about what Senator Kennedy said. Here's John, not related Kennedy from Louisiana.
Could you describe this bill?
Well, the bill's $2 trillion. Coming right behind it is another $3 trillion that President Biden wants for green infrastructure. The profligacy is mind-numbing. The motto of the Biden administration seems to be, we can't spend too much. Any fair-minded person knows that that's a very superficial, desultory, almost infantile approach. Either that or the people advising President Biden have an opium habit. I mean, any fool can spend money. The objective is not to spend money. It's not how much you spend. It's what you spend it on. 95% of President Biden's bill is not going to even be spent until 2022 and beyond. This isn't a coronavirus bill. This is a left of Lenin neo-socialist wish list. I mean, it just is.
First of all, I love the half Oxford, half Mr. Haney routine he does. He kind of merges the two together. The little folksy wisdom of Green Acres, but also
Wendell Douglas.
Right. by the way, he supported John Kerry for president in 2004.
Well, yeah, he was a Democrat.
Yeah, right.
But you know what I love about him. So yeah, I like he's using some mighty big words there, and pronouncing many of them correctly. But what I really like about it is that he's worried about this being, you know, this flat out socialism. What Biden's proposing is flat out socialism, and a lot of it doesn't kick in until 2022 or later. So it's like socialism, and in such small portions and so slowly.
Well, if we're going to roll out of this situation, does he not understand this pandemic's not over and a good portion of the country is going to be closed for the remainder of 2021?
Yeah. I mean, I think that John Kerry, who's actually one of the smarter senators around, whether you like him or not.
And I don't.
I respect that. But the other day he was in some hearing with Neera Tanden talking about the dialectic. I thought it was at a Marxist scholars conference. But he's a pretty smart guy. So I think he does recognize that. And that's what gets into the really creepy thing of this question of, do they really not want to succeed here? Would they genuinely prefer that we struggle along and remain in crisis, which, by the way, the last year has been a crisis. There's no question of that. Biden, whether you like him or not, appears at every turn to be trying to get us out of this mess. And he's doing things that are popular with his base, but also some things that aren't all that popular with his base. There does seem to be a drive to make things work. And the naysaying from Republicans who should be smarter, I expect Trump to be doing what Trump does, but the naysaying from Republicans who should be smarter suggests to me that we really are in a mode where there's a lot of these folks who would just prefer to see this administration fail, even at the enormous cost to the health, safety, and economic well-being of the American people.
So as we talk about the minimum wage in this whole dialogue, the Senate parliamentarian ruled that, in fact, it cannot be part of this reconciliation process. Some want to override the parliamentarian. Others are saying, in the past, we've gotten minimum wage bills through Republican Senates and houses by attaching it to, I guess it would have been a Democratic House and a Republican Senate, yeah. Attaching it to a defense bill and make them vote for it.
Yep. Or even potentially an infrastructure. You find different, kind of big packages that everybody likes, and then you attach to it, right? And that is one of the proposals. There's a bunch of options, to be honest, starting with fire the parliamentarian, of which there's a decent number of folks who want to.
But that doesn't solve the Manchin cinema problem.
That's my point. Yeah, exactly. This is where it gets complicated, right? But let's lay out the options so we're clear on it. Get rid of the parliamentarian, or at least overrule the parliamentarian. That's one. Number two, get rid of the filibuster, or at least restructure the filibuster. Number three, restructure this $1.9 trillion bill with models to create incentives to raise wages, i.e., use tax policy and other structures to do that. Or four, find a way to attach it to something else. Now, I favor alternate filibuster. I think that's a more meaningful long-term thing. Unfortunately, that runs into the Sinema, Manchin, and maybe several other senators' blockade. I am very sympathetic to, a little bit of restructuring on the $1.9 trillion bill to do some of the things that Bernie Sanders and Ron Wyden have talked about as regards incentivizing using tax policy and things like that. But it doesn't seem to be there's a lot of stomach to that in the administration or the Senate. So the truth of the matter is, if we're realistic, and this isn't necessarily where I'm at. I mean, I'd like to push a little harder on some of these other things. But if we're realistic, I think we're looking at a likelihood that we're talking about attaching to some other measure coming down the line. Now, here's an important thing. Biden is, he's got to lead on this. And so if they let the minimum wage go, if they let it drop out of this bill, when, by the way, it is exceptionally popular, people really do want this and need it. If they let it drop out, Biden's got to reposition fast with a real plan, and Democrats in the House and Senate do as well.
Well,
that's not just for his own party unity, which it is a tactic, but it's also for, you know, again, this sense that you really are delivering.
I'm amenable to playing around with the numbers here. I'm not sure it has to be $15. Here's the provision that I don't think anybody's talking about that I think would be more important than the actual number 15. People get fixated on the kind of myopic number of 15.
Yeah, yeah.
Is making sure that we build in a permanent indexing for this so we don't end up where next time we have a Republican president, it doesn't go up at all. Can't we put a permanent provision in here where this is indexed to inflation?
Yeah, I mean, the truth of the matter is that indexing, if we had indexed to inflation, you know, at the start, right, if it was, had always been indexed to inflation, you know, looking at the patterns that you had from in the period where it did kind of increase in a relatively steady pattern from 1938 to 1968, if you look at Dean Baker's analyses, you'd be at about $24, maybe $25 an hour right now, right? So we've been cheated out of you know, a lot of our wages for a long time. Now, I'm a little different than you on this. I think the 15 is a good baseline, but I think the 15 ought to be seen as a compromise. You know, it ought to be clearly communicated that raising.
Isn't it hard to compromise when you've thrown that number out, though? Shouldn't you have thrown a higher number out?
Well, it's an education issue. That you're right, but we should make it clear that if we kept, you know, we always want to say, you know, how do you get that situation you had in the 50s and 60s where, you know, somebody could work one job and support a family? And there was just, you know, there were a lot of elements of those times that people are nostalgic for, whether it's good, bad, or indifferent. But that's the reality. Well, the answer to that question is that, you know, A, you've got to boost wages a lot. And of course, you get to those where we were in those days, you got to boost wages to about $24, $25 an hour. Now, that's not going to happen, likely, in the immediate term. And so you educate about that, and then you talk about 15 not as some radical proposal, but indeed a moderate proposal, a proposal that doesn't begin to do what needs to be done, which is to say that if you work 40 hours a week, you shouldn't live in poverty. Simple as that.
We'll take a break. We got to take a break here. John Nichols from the Capital Times and The Nation talking to us at slysoffice.com.
I want to thank all the labor unions here in Dane County that help keep slysoffice.com up and going so you keep up to date, whether it be the Madison Firefighters, Local 311, or the Madison Teamsters, Local 695, or our friends at Madison Teachers Incorporated. These are some of the most active local unions who organize, and constantly stand up for workers. Thank you from slysoffice.com.
When you're looking for a new computer or need help with one you already own, call 231-8000 and Madison Computer Works will get things up and running for you. Madison Computer Works, computers that work for you.
Welcome back to slysoffice.com, brought to you by our friends at Madison Computer Works, also Jeff's Guitar Clinic. Joining us again, John Nichols from the Capital Times and The Nation. So, CPAC, quite an interesting... Star Wars scene there at the bar. Here is Brian Williams talking about Ted Cruz.
As we mentioned, Ted Cruz now finds Florida preferable to all those constituent problems back home in Texas. He thrilled the crowd with something of an uncomfortably high volume and overamped lounge act.
Orlando is awesome! It's not as nice as Cancun. Let me tell you this right now, Donald J. Trump ain't going anywhere. Bernie is wearing mittens. And AOC is telling us she was murdered. In the immortal words of William Wallace, freedom!
...cated than most folks.
Yeah. Again,
where do you begin with that?
Again, another Ivy Leaguer kind of trying to sound like Mr. Haney.
Yeah, kind of. No, I mean, Mr. Haney was far more responsible and you know, intellectually sound person than Ted Cruz. And I'm going to make you retract that insult. remember when Mr. Haney was the plant manager, right? He was in his little place and he said, I'm the plant manager. And Oliver looked at him, and he had like all these little plants growing in front of him.
I love that show. Whoever did the writing for that show had to have been high. Seriously,
it was a subversive program by any means, and it really wrecked a lot of people's minds. But with that said, if Ted Cruz had watched it, you know, maybe he would have turned out somewhat more normal. The Ted Cruz thing there was surreal. And the truth of the matter is that if you were making, you know, this would be like Martin Scorsese would have to do this, right? You know, but if you're making a movie about a senator kind of melting down, losing it, you know, like falling apart in some sort of tragic Scarface sort of way, this would be it, right? I mean, that performance was desperate. And needy and pathetic and deeply troubled. And a couple things I'll tell you. Number one, they weren't applauding for Ted Cruz. They were applauding for Donald Trump, right? That's an important thing to understand. They were applauding for the cruelty in the speech. They were applauding for the, you know, cheap one-liners in the speech. But they weren't applauding for Ted Cruz. He is such a mess of a human being at this point. Such a tragic parody of his own self that he was allowed on that stage to do exactly what he did to make himself a laughingstock. And I don't think they intended that per se. You know, they thought, oh, we're going to let Cruz embarrass himself. But that was, he was allowed there because they know that he is so desperate. He will be an absolute Trump loyalist. He will be an absolute talking point, you know, over the top CPACer, right? And that's kind of that's a really tragic place to end up. I would dare say Ted Cruz is degenerating into Scott Walker territory.
Well, Scott Walker was tweeting out praise for Donald Trump's speech yesterday. Here is Brian Williams talking about our senior senator from Wisconsin.
To hear remarks or questions from a guy, I'll use his new nickname given to him this week, Ronanon Johnson from Wisconsin, a guy who plainly knows better. We've been talking about the big lie. Actually, if we're being honest, there were many. There's Obama wasn't born in the United States. There's it's just like the flu. It's going to disappear. All these educated folks buying in to the big lies. Does it make for tension? What on earth must it be like since there's only 100 of you in that chamber at one time?
Yeah, I always hesitate to kind of pull back the curtain in terms of individual members of the Senate because it, you know, feels like a personal attack and it's something that as a senator you try not to do. But let me tell you, I'm not sure Ron Johnson does know better. There are really, really, really smart people that are Republican senators that know better. Ted Cruz, Josh Hawley, I could put a whole bunch of them in that bucket. Rick Scott, Marco Rubio. But I'm not sure about Ron Johnson. I mean, he spent most of the last 4 years wanting to talk about Hillary Clinton's emails. I mean, how dumb was that? We had, you know, this burgeoning problem of domestic terrorism, and he was the chairman of the committee that I was ranking on that should have been having hearings on this years ago. He had one, you know, drive-by hearing on it and really didn't ever signal to the administration that this is something that should be taken seriously, and we saw what the result was.
Could you describe?
All right. So, in the tragedy department, where would you put Ron Johnson versus Ted Cruz?
Oh, that's a good one. I think that Cruz is the bigger tragedy, and I'll say that. It's probably the nicest thing I'll ever say about Ron Johnson. Ron Johnson started so low, right? you know, it's like he started on the curb and fell into the gutter, right? Ted Cruz, actually, if you'll recall, as absurd and obnoxious a person as he's been, once upon a time was in a kind of a stronger place. Might I note that Ted Cruz won the Wisconsin primary in 2016. He is the immediate former, before, you know, trophies in 2020, he is the immediate former favorite of Wisconsin Republicans to be president of the United States. And so he was in a different, stronger place once upon a time. He has fallen precipitously and notably. Whereas Ron Johnson, I mean, look, with all due respect, what they were saying on that show, and Claire McCaskill, I think, was pretty blunt about it, is that there's kind of a chance Ron Johnson might not be the sharpest tack in the box. Is that a fair assessment there?
Well, I think when he was asked when he first ran for the United States Senate in 2010 what his inspiration was, and he said it was Dick Morris on television, that might have been a clue right there.
Well, or the fact that my favorite interview with him ever was, you know, and it's never gotten the traction it deserves. They should unearth it now. Because it's sort of like people think, wow, what happened to Ron Johnson? Why did he lose it so badly? He didn't lose it. He's always been here. There was an interview with him when he was in his first term, not too long after he was elected, where he goes over to the Ayn Rand Institute, right? You know, the libertarian, well, the whatever they call her, writer of Atlas Shrugged and stuff like that. And he does this long interview with them. And he makes Paul Ryan look like a, you know, a casual Ayn Rand reader, right? And you know what they say about Ayn Rand, right? You know, that it's like she is the writer for, you know, like 16-year-old boys who feel like they're, for the 16-year-old wealthy white kids who feel like they're oppressed, right? And so he's going on and on about how much he likes her and stuff like that. And then he starts talking about buying a statue of Atlas, because she wrote this book, Atlas Shrugged, to put into his factory, or to put in front of his factory, right? And you realize this is he's been a weird person who is sort of easily duped and, you know, kind of out there on the edge for a very, very long time.
If you had to bet money, would you place it on him running for re-election or following his pledge not to?
You know, I have thought a lot about that, and I operate on the presumption that he's going to run. And I think that the reason for that is that he clearly, and I know that this, again, I'm going to say something nicer about him than he deserves. I think that Claire McCaskill is right, that he may not be as sharp as many of these other folks. He may actually feel he has a duty to run. You know, that it is his mission to run. And if that is indeed the case, that's exactly how he'll frame it. You know, I didn't plan to run, but I have to save the country, blah, blah, blah. Now, it's important to understand that his fellow Republicans would be thrilled if he didn't run. This is one of the lost, you know, realities. They've got plenty of people on that bench who could run as a stronger candidate than Ron Johnson in 2022. In fact, it may well be that Ron Johnson is uniquely positioned to lose the seat for the Republicans because of, you know, exactly what we've seen, the absurdity of the situation, the absurdity of what he's become. But that doesn't necessarily mean he won't go for it. And if he does go for it, because he will have Trump's 100% backing, he's not going to have a primary challenge. And he cannot be pushed aside. That's the important thing to recognize, because anybody who's trying to push Ron Johnson aside is going to have to deal with Trump, because after Josh Hawley, no senator has been more loyal to Trump than Ron Johnson.
Well, and Ron Johnson has developed a very close relationship with all the conservative hosts in the state. He's on talk radio most of the day, every day.
Yeah.
I don't know what he's doing as a senator. It isn't helping his constituents. He's on talk radio every day, and that's the world he lives in. All right, so...
And he lives in these conspiracy, right? You know, he's down there. He's not even talking about Wisconsin issues. He's coming on to talk about these conspiracy theories.
No. All right. So finally, this is Donald Trump's, part of Donald Trump's speech to CPAC.
Instead of attacking me and, more importantly, the voters of our movement, top establishment Republicans in Washington should be spending their energy in opposing Biden, Pelosi, Schumer, and the Democrats. The Democrats don't have grandstanders like Mitt Romney, Little Ben Sasse, Richard Burr, Bill Cassidy, Susan Collins, Lisa Murkowski, Pat Toomey, the warmonger, a person that loves seeing our troops fighting, Liz Cheney. The good news is, in her state, she's been censured, and in her state, her poll numbers have dropped faster than any human being I've ever seen. So hopefully they'll get rid of her with the next election. Get rid of them all.
All right, John, your thoughts on what the former president just said?
A lot of people will think that he went on stage there and was mean to the people who have, you know, dared to stand up to him. And he did say some kind of mean things about him, to be sure.
Although I did enjoy the Liz Cheney warmonger thing. That was
completely accurate.
Yeah, completely.
You know, yeah. I wrote a long piece saying, you know, let's not make her a hero. I think a lot of people will hear it as, oh yeah, he went after the people who parted with him, and he's signaling that he's going to, you know, support primary challenge. Yeah, we knew that before, right?
Oops, you cut out there for a minute. Go ahead, say that again.
Yeah, we knew that before. But what's notable is that he came on stage there either having memorized or having written down their names, right? It was clear he was taking this very seriously. That wasn't about the people he was calling out from the stage. That was a message to everyone else, to every other Republican. If you think that you can get rid of me, if you think you can move away from me, if you think you can ignore me, you can't. I'm going to take names. I'm going to call them out. I'm going to punish. And I thought that was one of the most fascinating sort of subtexts to the speech. I think there are two ones that were really fascinating. That, and then also the fact that, oh, no, there's no way we're forming a third party. And he very clearly and aggressively rejected a third party. So the core message from Trump's speech, you put these two pieces together, is he owns the Republican Party, and he is going to punish anybody within that party who isn't 100% loyal to him. That is a very stark statement.
John Nichols from the Capital Times and the Nation. Thanks for coming to Sly's Office.
Sly'sOffice.com.
Thanks a million.
Bye-bye.